have yielded the ground rather than a statement of something new, but see what I can do. So the main actor of this talk is an equal four supersymmetric gauge theory in four dimensions. So an equal four supermeans. Okay, this is a very nice theory. It has a lot of beautiful properties. Essentially, it's a theory of a gauge field transforming in the joint of some group. I should write bigger, right? A bunch of scalars, fermions, which I'll never really discuss, and six scalar fields transforming in the joint. A way to think about this theory is that it's a dimensional reduction of the of a Yamil's theory in 10 dimensions. So if you want to write the equations of motions for the Lagrangian for this theory, essentially just write the Lagrangian for Yamil's theory in 10 dimensions, and you pretend that six of the components of the gauge field are scalar fields. Okay? So you get something like F mu nu squared plus the mu phi I squared plus phi I phi j squared. All the field transforming the joint of some gauge group G. Plus fermions. So this theory has a lot of supersymmetry, has 16 supercharges. It has an exactly marginal coupling. So the gauge, the Yamil's coupling is exactly marginal. It's usually combined with the theta angle into a complex number. So here there was some theta angle too. I'll never remember the normalization right, so. And actually there was a trace everywhere. Okay. And one of the most striking properties of this theory is this duality. So it's a statement that if you take this gauge coupling to be very strong, a dual description of the theory emerges in terms of a new weak gauge coupling and a new gauge group. So, right here. And you can four supermeals with the gauge group G and coupling tau is dual, is literally identical to n equal 4 supermeals for some dual group, Langlands dual group, and dual coupling, which is just minus 1 over tau. This is the basic statement of this duality. Now, for most observables, this is a statement which is very hard to check, because clearly, if this coupling is weak, this coupling is very strong. So if calculations are easy on one side, they're very hard on the other side. But for some protected quantities, supersymmetric quantities, which are protected from interactions, that one can easily match. Now, today's story is not just about n equal 4 supermeals, it's about boundary conditions or interfaces for n equal 4 supermeals. So we consider this gauge theory in the presence of a boundary. boundary, we should preserve some part of the supersymmetry as much as possible. The amount is called 3D n equal 4. This essentially means it preserves 8 supercharges out of 16. Some other condition cannot preserve all supersymmetries because supersymmetries square to translations, and the boundary condition breaks translation symmetry in one direction. So you can preserve some sort of maximal set of supersymmetries, which do not square to this translation, but only translations along the boundary. And maybe I should have said something about the supersymmetry algebra, but just schematically, there are a bunch of supersymmetries with some indices, which I don't worry about, and they square to translations. OK. Now, it's not completely obvious, but as duality acts in a nice way, not just on the bulk theory, but also on the boundary conditions. So if you give me some supersymmetric boundary conditions in this gauge theory, I can try to map it to a supersymmetric boundary condition for this theory. Well, map it means that every aspect of the physics will coincide once I identify the couplings in the proper way. So I call this dual boundary condition B-dual. So this is called as duality. OK. So OK, there is a nice problem, which is to ask, what are the possible pairs of boundary conditions? Okay. And I studied this problem a few years ago with Witten, and we produced a rough strategy on how to produce the dual boundary condition given a boundary condition, and we also produced a very long list of dual pairs of boundary conditions. The basic trick we used to produce this list was to embed this problem in string theory, but this duality acts in a very well understood manner, and play around with D-brains until we produced all these examples. Now, perhaps I should also remind you of what are Langland dual groups. Sorry. So, but if you think about just a UN gauge theory, you don't have to worry about what Langland duality, you know, what about that, because UN is as dual to UN. If you pick other gauge groups, there is a slightly more subtle map from one gauge group to the dual. But I will content myself with UN examples anyway, so this is enough for now. Now, in order to get to the geometric Langland, to the relation with geometric Langlands, we need to do a few more steps. The first step is to compactify the system on a Riemann surface. So study a spacetime on the form R1, 1, or maybe R times R plus, because there is still the boundary condition, times a surface C. I will explain momentarily that when you do that, the two-dimensional theory reduces to a two-dimensional theory, effectively, at least at large distances. And this two-dimensional theory, it's roughly a sigma model. So it's a theory of maps from the two-dimensional spacetime into some target manifold, which is called the Hitchin moduli space. When you compactify this side of duality, you similarly get a sigma model on the Hitchin moduli space for the dual group. And the relation between these two theories takes the form of a mirror symmetry, two-dimensional mirror symmetry. I mean, just because there is an S-duality on this side, you know that these theories must also be the same. But the way they are the same is very non-trivial. So this is a theory of maps into some space. This is a theory of maps into a potentially different space. Even when the space is the same because the group is the same, this is not a trivial equality. Observables like the observables of this sigma model get remixed in a very complicated way under this mirror symmetry. Now, if I had a boundary to start with, I would have a boundary here. Maybe I should tell you something about the supersymmetry of this. A sigma model which preserves 4 8 supercharges. It's called the 4.4 sigma model. When you go down to two dimensions, there are two possible choices of how to align the supersymmetries preserved by the boundary with the operation of compactification. I will be more specific in a moment. But let's just say that there are two possible boundary conditions. I can call it the boundary condition of type BAA or the boundary condition of type BBB. And I'll explain what this means in a moment. But under the mirror symmetry, the role of this is exchanged. So from this boundary condition, I can also get a BBB brain, which is going to be mirror to this. Or I can get a BAA brain, which is going to be mirror to this. Mirror means, again, that these boundary conditions are, you know, very different looking boundary conditions for different looking theories. But in the quantum field theory, they actually turn out to be the same in a very non-trivial manner. Okay, so if you want a big part of my project was to try to figure out, given a boundary condition here, which boundary conditions emerge here? With the aim of taking some of these dual pairs that I built with Witten and convert them into mirror pairs in here. Now, finally, if you want to get to geometric Langlands, there is one more step, which is a topological twist. Which allows you to forget about a lot of the physics going on and keep only some very basic properties of the system, which are still very intricate, but manageable. So some sort of mathematical fingerprint of these boundary conditions. This mathematical fingerprint is called either a dim module on some space called ban G, or depending if you're looking at this or this, a sheaf on the space of local systems. And so when you twist the other side of the duality, you're going to get a sheaf again, or a D-module, this time for the dual group. And again, so this two-dimensional mirror symmetry manifests itself into some correspondence between these objects. This correspondence is called geometric Langlands duality. Now the story of the history of the subject goes in a very different way than what I do on this blackboard. There is some general program in number theory called the Langlands program, about which I can say almost nothing because I don't know how to do number theory in physics. That program inspired another program called the geometric Langlands program that was matching some data here with some data here. And then at some point, Kapustin and Witten proposed that this match was a manifestation of mirror symmetry originating from its duality. So my hope is that starting from dual pairs of boundary conditions here, carrying them to boundary conditions here, and then extracting the mathematical fingerprint, I will get lists of dual objects in geometric Langlands, which might be of interest. Now, a caveat is that although as duality in the bulk relates something weakly coupled to something weakly coupled, really, you start from something weakly coupled, you make it strongly coupled, and then you map it to something weakly coupled again. But if you're lucky, the mathematical fingerprints will not depend on the coupling. So there will be something you can compute on both sides. It's also possible that the boundary is a weakly coupled boundary condition might go to a boundary condition which remains strongly coupled, even when you make this coupling weak. There might be some strongly coupled dynamics at the boundary. When that happens, our computational ability is clearly very impaired. So what I'm going to describe today applies mostly to pairs of boundary conditions, so both sides are weakly coupled. We have a lot of those examples, but there are other examples where that's not the case. And some of these examples where this is not the case are very interesting for geometric Langlands, and we will not be able to deal with them with the tools I'm describing now. There is some work in progress on how to deal with them, but it's separate.
Non-weakly
coupled, I mean that you might have a Lagrangian, but some of the symmetries or properties that you care about emerge only in the infrared when the physics becomes strongly coupled.
Maybe you can still compute some things there.
Well, if the symmetries are emergent, it becomes very hard to use them. And I give some concrete examples.
We know examples of things that you can see that are not manifest in the UV, but you can see them in the infrared.
That's right. So these are things that emerge in the infrared. So if I'm doing a calculation, I try to do it in terms of the fields that live in the UV.
Yes.
I might just not be able to do some things. For example, some of this calculation requires me to couple the theory to a flat connection for some symmetry. Yes. If the symmetry only emerges in the infrared, I'm in trouble. So of course, you could somehow hope to build a strong enough mathematical fingerprint of the theory, which even if it's computed in the UV, still knows about the symmetry that it will emerge in infrared, and then can be used to do calculations. And I think I might have something like that, but it requires yet another level of abstraction on top of this, and I don't want to discuss it today. Okay. Now, so let me try to put a bit more data about the various actors of this on this blackboard. I don't think I need to tell you much more about any of four super mirrors itself. The only thing you really need to remember is that it has gauge fields and 6 scalar fields value in the joint. Now, in the bulk, all of these fields are related to them to each other by supersymmetry. So, for example, the equations of motion for all the fields are determined just from the equations of motion of the gauge field. When we build boundary conditions, if you want to preserve some supersymmetry, this will relate in a similar way the boundary condition of the gauge field to the boundary condition of some of the other fields. So typically, it's enough for me to tell you what the boundary condition is going to be on the gauge field, and all the other boundary conditions will follow. The choice of supersymmetry preserved by the boundary condition sort of breaks the symmetry between the scalar fields. In the bulk, the scalar fields are rotated by an SO6 global symmetry. When we define boundary conditions, we are going to break it to an SO3 times SO3. Which means 3 of the scalar fields will be treated one way, and 3 of the scalar fields will be treated another way. Let me give you examples of boundary conditions. One simple example is Neumann boundary conditions. Neumann boundary conditions means that the gauge fields survive at the boundary, but the component of the gauge of the field strength perpendicular to the boundary, with one leg perpendicular to the boundary and the other leg parallel to the boundary, vanishes. Now you can sort of try to think, when did you ever encounter boundary conditions like that, say in electrodynamics? So what does this boundary condition mean? Well, for example, if time runs along the boundary, this means that the electric field perpendicular to the boundary vanishes, and the magnetic field parallel to the boundary vanishes. You can ask yourself if you ever encountered boundary conditions like that in the Jacksons, for example. Once you have this boundary condition, the boundary condition for the other fields follow. And for example, you have the normal derivative of the scalar fields 1, 2, and 3 vanish. This is also called Neumann boundary condition for these scalar fields. And on the other hand, the fields, the phi 4 to phi 6, are set to 0 at the boundary. Okay. So this is one example of supersymmetric boundary condition. Something you can do is to add extra matter fields that live only at the boundary. When you do so, the boundary condition for gauge fields is deformed to something like that. Again, what does it mean? It means that the electric field perpendicular to the boundary equals to some boundary density, charge density, and the magnetic field parallel to the boundary equals to some boundary surface current, not surface current, some boundary current. Now, this should be really familiar. And similarly, so these boundary conditions do not change, while these ones get modified. as well. There are some functions of the boundary fields which end up on the right-hand side. They're called moment maps. Let me not worry for now about what they are. OK, and a third possibility could be Dirichlet. With Dirichlet boundary conditions, you just set to zero the connection parallel to the boundary. So the gauge fields and the gauge symmetry stop, are not dynamical at the boundary. And similarly, you have the phi 1 to phi 2, phi 3 vanish, and the normal derivative of phi 4, phi 5, and phi 6 vanish. A neat property of the Dirichlet boundary conditions is that the gauge group becomes a global symmetry at the boundary. Because the gauge transformations are maps, become maps into the group, which go to one at the boundary. And the gauge transformations which are constant at the boundary remains as a global symmetry. When you have the Dirichlet boundary condition, you can do things like putting F mu nu at the boundary. And it's a well-defined operator, even if it will not be gauge invariant in the bulk. This is very important. And in particular, you can actually couple these boundary conditions to some background connection for G in three dimensions, just by saying, OK, let me replace this with some fixed connection. And similarly here. So Dirichlet boundary conditions can be labeled by a connection on the boundary. Now, the next thing I would like to discuss is the compactification to two dimensions. Now, if you just take a theory, and supersymmetric theory, and you compactify it as it is, typically you break supersymmetry. It's not good because we want to use supersymmetry to do calculations. There is a way to modify the theory before you compactify it, which allows you to preserve some of the supersymmetry. The basic problem is that the superchargers are spinors, and typically you don't have you cannot define a constant spinor over the whole Riemann surface. But if you sort of change the Lorentz, the way the field transform and the Lorentz transformations a little bit, you can end up with a supercharge which is a scalar, and then it can be defined over the whole Riemann surface. So essentially what you do to, this is called the twisting, it's a very important operation. What you're gonna do is you're gonna say we take an SO2 inside SO6, and then we change the Lorentz indices on the Riemann surface by mixing Lorentz symmetry with these SO2 rotations. In other words, what's going to happen is that through the scalar field, say phi1 and phi2, are going to be transformed into some one forms on the surface, while the other ones remain normal scalar fields. And similarly, some of the fermions are modified. So the fields that we have when you reduce on the Riemann surface are going to be the gauge fields in space-time, the gauge field along the Riemann surface, and then these one forms and the scalar fields. And we in going to the Riemann surface, we do break some supersymmetry. We go from 16 to X per charges. And because of that, the fields don't stop mixing all with each other under supersymmetry transformations. Rather, these, which carry indices along the Riemann surface, mix together. And these ones mix together. And these are the four fields that will play the most important role. So we take this gauge theory, we twist it, we put it on a Riemann surface, and we ask what happens at low energy, long distances. Well, the first question we can ask is, are there any field configurations on the Riemann surface which have very low energy or zero energy? Those will dominate the physics at low energy. So it turns out that the potential for these fields is a sum of squares. And if you set the things inside those squares to be zero, you get a zero energy configuration. Okay. So I wonder where to write. Maybe I'll go here. So the equations that had to be satisfied for the configuration of the fields to have zero energy and be supersymmetric are the following. You want phi z to be holomorphic. You want phi z bar to be anti-holomorphic. And then you want the field strength to equal the commutator between phi and phi bar. I never get this sign right. It's either plus or minus one of the two makes sense, the other doesn't. Anyway, so these are very important equations in mathematical physics. They are called Hitchin equations. So if you give me a Riemann surface and a group, I can try to solve these equations on the Riemann surface for the group. And there will be some moduli space of solutions. So these equations have a lot of solutions, a finite dimensional moduli space of solutions, called the Hitchin moduli space. So these solutions, modulo gauge transformations, give you the Hitchin moduli space. So this gauge theory, compactifying the Riemann surface at low energy, behaves for most purposes as a sigma model into the Hitchin moduli space, meaning that in each point of space-time, I want to have a zero energy configuration of very low energy. So at each point of space-time, I solve these equations on the Riemann surface. I find that gives me a point here. And so I have a slowly varying solution of the Hitchin system as I move around space-time. The quantum field theory of maps into a space are called sigma models, nonlinear sigma models. That's why I say that we get a nonlinear sigma model into this space. Okay. Now, the space has a lot of nice properties. In particular, this is hyperkähler. Now, an hyperkähler manifold is a sort of a quaternionic generalization of a complex manifold. Instead of having just one complex structure, it has three complex structures, which satisfies the properties of the quaternions. So I square equal to minus 1, j square equal to minus 1, k square equal to minus 1, ij plus ji equal to 0, etc. Now, the simplest example of an Eppel-Keeler manifold is R4. If I take R4, I can think about it as a complex manifold in many ways. I could say that x1 plus ix2 is a complex variable, and x3 plus ix4 is a complex variable. Or I might decide that x1 plus ix3 is a complex variable, and x2 plus ix4, and so on. And there is a variety of possibilities. In Eppel-Keeler manifolds, there is actually a whole sphere, CP1 world of possibilities, because you can take anything like AI plus BJ plus CK, and it will square to minus 1, as long as A squared plus B squared plus C squared is 1. You know, all the mixed terms cancel out because of this. So, for example, in R4, if I want to think about R4 as an Eppel-Keeler manifold, I will say, okay, I could define complex coordinates x1 plus ix2 and x3 plus ix4. I can define other complex coordinates. For example, I could say that u plus zeta v bar is a complex coordinate, and v minus zeta u bar is a complex coordinate. This defines another complex structure in R4. And we call it I zeta, or J zeta. It's parameterized by a complex number. And actually, you can take even to be infinity and say that V bar and minus V bar are your complex coordinates. So this gives me CP1 worth of complex structures. So a sphere worth of complex structures. So in general, I can parameterize my complex structures in somehow like this. You can use stereographic coordinates on the sphere. And you can ask, what are the holomorphic coordinates in this complex structure? So for an Eppel-Keeler manifold, you can answer this question for every complex structure, for a whole CP1 world of complex structures. Another example could be R2 times T2. I could say that my coordinates, I can use some local coordinates like x, x bar, and some theta 1 and theta 2 coordinates on the torus. So in complex structure I, maybe the complex coordinates will be x and something like theta 1 minus tau theta 2. But tau is a modular parameter of the torus. In generic complex structure, I could say that they are something like e to the x over zeta plus I theta 1 plus x bar zeta and e to the tau x plus I theta 2. Plus tau bar x bar zeta. Sorry. So just to say, there are a variety of Eppel-Keeler manifolds, and R4 is a very simple example. R2 times T2 is a simple example. For example, if you look at R2 times T2, in one complex structure, you see C times a complex torus, an elliptic curve, I guess I should say, and in a generic complex structure, you see C star times C star. The Hitchin modular space is somewhat analogous to this. I'll show you momentarily. It has one special complex structure where it looks like some flat, some complex space, vector space, plus some tori fibered over it. And in generic complex structures, it just looks like something with a lot of coordinates on it, a lot of functions on it. It has a lot of patch, coordinate patches in which it looks like C star to the end glued together in some complicated way. So how do you figure out how does this look like in some as a complex manifold? Now, it turns out that it's actually much easier to answer than asking what does this look like as a manifold. Meaning, to find this manifold, you need to solve three equations and mod by unitary gauge transformations. But once you pick a complex structure, it turns out that you can pick two of these equations, make them into a complex equation, and throw away the third equation and replace it with a quotient by complexified gauge transformations. So everything becomes holomorphic and easy up to some stability conditions or whatever. So people, particularly most mathematicians, would not like to speak about this much as talk about the complex manifolds that you get by picking complex structure here. So in generic complex structures, your holomorphic functions look a lot like this. What do I mean? I mean that we have phi, phi bar, and the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic derivatives, or if you want, AZ and AZ bar. And the holomorphic combinations look like AZ bar plus phi over zeta. Let me call it A zeta. AZ. And AZ bar plus phi bar zeta. Now, the magic fact is that if these equations hold, then these combinations give a flat connection. So so d z plus phi over z zeta d z bar plus zeta phi bar commutator vanishes. If you ever looked at something like integrable systems, you might recognize something like a Lax connection. So a family of flat connections which some parameter, with a property that requiring it to be flat for all values of the parameter, gives you some interesting equations. So what you can do is just to take this flat connection and compute the holonomies. You know, do a path-order of exponential. Pick your Riemann surface. Pick a curve along it. Maybe this is a bit trivial. That should be fine. Curve around it and do something like a path order exponential. Okay. This gives you a nice function, holomorphic function, in this complex structure zeta. So you have a lot of them, and they look, you know, rough. They look like holonomies, and if you stare at them a lot, they start resembling a lot something like this. Okay, so in this complex structure, the Hitching system becomes what's called the space of local systems. So the Hitching system in complex structure zeta becomes a space of local system, a space of flat connections on your Riemann surface. Now, it's not obvious, right? So what is not obvious is that if you give me a flat connection, which means something like this modulo complexified gauge transformation, I can find a solution to the Hitchian equations. But this is a theorem. that you can always do so. So looking at it like this does not miss any information. Does not miss any information, sorry. So this, now this definition works for every zeta different from zero and infinity. So if you think about the sphere of complex structures, almost everywhere you have this local system. Now, of course, if you pick a complex structure and you give me a local system and you solve the Hitchin equations, then you change the complex structure and you go see which connection do you, which local system do you get, which fast connection do you get, you get something else. It's a very non-trivial problem to say, give me a point in one complex structure and produce the point in a different complex structure. It's extremely hard. And indeed, it's a problem that whenever you try to describe, to study this setup mathematically, you try to avoid as much as possible because it's very hard. Now, I've not told, I should tell you now what to do as zeta is equal to zero. When zeta is equal to zero, the holomorphic variables are just a z bar and phi. Mathematically, a z bar gives us a bundle and phi So a z bar defines some bundle E and phi is some section, some holomorphic section, something like, so it's a matrix which is also a one form. Okay, if you don't know this notation, forget about it, you don't need to know it. But you know, it's just a one form which transforms in a joint representation of the gauge of this complexified gauge group. And if you like bundles, it's this. Now, and in here, the thing I call stability comes about. So if you just give me a generic A z bar and a generic phi, you typically can solve Hitchin equations for these, but sometimes in some rare situations you cannot. So there is an extra condition that is put on called stability, which you can test to make sure that you can get the Hitchin system out of something like this. So there is a notion of stability for the pair, or the two, which is what tells you that you have a solution to the Hitchin equations. And then there is another slightly stronger condition of stability for the bundle by itself. So the moduli space of stable bundles is something which is nice. It's called Ban G. So, and if your bundle is stable, this whole pair will also be stable. So, you can get most solution of Hitchin equations by taking a stable bundle and adding to it a Higgs field. This uses what's called a cotangent bundle to Ban G. And this is not the whole of the Hitchin system, but it's most of the Hitchin system. Okay? So in most mathematical descriptions, people focus on this, on information derived out of this. So in particular, in the geometric Langlands program is statements that are typically formulated in terms of this space. There is another description which is very important in order to understand neurosymmetry, which is due to Hitchin, and which I would like to describe now. From this description, it's not clear at all that this space resembles R2 times T2. Okay. It looks like the cotangent bundle to something very messy. Now, there is this extremely beautiful construction, though, which trace this data for something simpler. Intuitively, the construction goes as follows. You take this, and you diagonalize phi. And you study the eigenvalues of phi, instead of studying the whole thing. Eigenvalues and eigenvectors of phi. So for example, you can try to write down, you can say something like this, okay, let me take phi and look at its characteristic polynomial. Okay. This looks like, suppose that we are working with un. How does this look like? Well, there is, starts with x to the n, and then there is going to be the trace of phi, which is going to be some one form. And then there's going to be this some combination of trace of phi squared and trace of phi squared, which is going to be some true form. Something with true indices, a quadratic differential is called. And so on and so forth. Okay. So part of the data of this Higgs bundle is just the characteristic polynomial of phi, you know, the traces of phi and its powers. These are nice because phi satisfies del bar phi equal to zero, then all of these, which are now scalars, not matrices anymore, are just on holomorphic. So part of the data is just this list, a one form, a quadratic differential, a cubic differential, and so on, which are holomorphic. So this is a nice, it is a vector space. You know, if you give me two of these collections, I can just add them up and get the third collection. The space of these characteristic polynomials is a linear space. So this plays the role of this R2. So there is a big base parameterized by this phi 1, phi 2, and so on. Okay. And then, but this is only half of the data. Actually, so you can prove that this gives half of the information. Where is the other half hidden? Well, at the points, at the values of x where this determinant vanishes, x minus phi will have some zero eigenvector. Or, I mean, this setting this polynomial equal to zero, right, gives you the eigenvalues of phi. So if I set, let me call this polynomial p of xz, right? If I set p of xz equal to zero, I'll find some x's of z, which are the eigenvalues of phi. So I can try to solve this equation now, phi v equal to xv. Okay, that's easy, I can always do it. But because phi is holomorphic and x is holomorphic in z, I could try to do it in a holomorphic way. I could look for some v which also satisfy del bar v equal to zero. Now, it turns out this is not possible, at least not globally. Locally you can do it, but you can, if you try to glue together these eigenvectors all of the Riemann surface, you fail. But the failure is just an overall scale. You know, an eigenvector is only defined up to a scaling, and this hits you. The way it hits is just that you need to include the possibility of a little one form, you know, a U1 connection on top of that. So essentially what you get is the following. You had this Riemann surface, C. Then you have this equation. This equation lives naturally in T star of C, because this is naturally one form, you know, the direction of the cotangent bundle of C. So this equation gives you a more complicated curve, which sits over C. It's called the spectral curve. And project, you know, different points on the spectral curve are different eigenvalues of phi. And then on this spectral curve, we can look for this abelian gauge field, which allows us to solve this problem. So we get the data of a spectral curve and a line bundle on the spectral curve. An abelian, you know, something like this up to U1 gauge transformation, to GL1 gauge transformation. The space of possible, so the magical thing is that this map can be inverted. So if you give me these ones, these phis, and you give me a z bar, you can find uniquely the Higgs bundle. Mathematically, this is called the push forward of the data on the Riemann surface. But concretely, it just means this. And so there is one-to-one correspondence. Which means that we can describe this space just as a space of possible, as the linear space together with a line bundle on the spectral curve. The space of line bundles is a torus. You know, just parameterized by the, if you want, roughly by the law. I shouldn't say that. But. Anyway, so you get the Hitching system becomes a vibration of tori over a flat base. It's something called a complex integrable system, because there is actually a symplectic form on this space, and all of this data Poisson commute and give Hamiltonians, which move you along the fibers. And mirror symmetry is just a form of t-duality. So if you look at the Hitching modulized space for the group G, or the Hitching modulized space for the dual group, they have the same base, and the torus fibers are in a sense dual to each other, t-dual to each other. Now, if you haven't encountered t-duality yet, this statement might be hard to digest. But actually means that, for example, local operators in your theory which have momentum along this torus this perspective is very useful to understand two-dimensional mirror symmetry. So mirror symmetry tells you how to map boundary conditions on one sigma model to boundary conditions in the other sigma model. An example is that, so what are boundary conditions for a sigma model? You have in the bulk, you have maps from spacetime into some manifold. You can say that, for example, you can say that the boundary, those maps don't go wherever they want, but they go to some specific location, for example. They will tell you that the maps at the boundary go to some point, say. Then you ask yourself, what boundary condition you get on the mirror side? And I get a boundary condition where the maps go to some point in the base, but wherever they want on the fiber. This is an example of mirror boundary conditions. And actually, they are the main concern of the geometric Langlands program. Geometric Langlands program is asking which sort of boundary condition do I get on this side given this point here. But they don't ask it in this complex structure where this is pretty easy to see. They ask it in other complex structures. So this point is also a point in the space of local systems. So the question they're asking is, if I take a point on a space of local systems, I map it to a point in this space in some very hard way, map it to this, to this submanifold here, and then try to map it yet again to some more complicated fingerprint, what do I get? Now, unfortunately, I cannot answer that question because although this side has a weakly coupled description in gauge theory, this side has a strongly coupled description in gauge theory. So to address this in gauge theory requires more powerful tools than the ones I was hoping to describe today, and I didn't. But there are other boundary conditions which might give you, might tell you that the maps end on some submanifold here on one side and some other submanifold here on the other side. And so this gives you pairs of objects in this geometric Lang-Lang program. Okay, and if I had another hour, I would explain how to derive which submanifolds correspond to a given boundary condition in the gauge theory side. I think I should stop.